that. Other guys made a type of alcohol in their cells they called Pruno, which was like a wine made from orange juice, sugar, and for yeast, a loaf of bread. It took 2 weeks to make a batch, and when one was done, you'd hear everybody getting drunk as fuck and partying. It practically turned into a nightclub in there. One dude taught me how to take my trash bag, fill it with water, and tie a knot in the center to make 10-pound dumbbells to work out with. So I started doing curls with fucking water bags, which were illegal, so I had to hide them under my bed. Other dudes would make dice by filing down the balls from their roll-on deodorant on the cement of their floors until they were square. Or they'd make knives by rolling up newspaper tighter and tighter for hours, until the paper basically reverted to its original form, wood, and could be used to stab someone like a steak. One old dude taught me how to light a cigarette. Take a pencil and chew the wood off until you get to the lead, which carries electricity. Then take a disposable razor, break it open with your shoe, and remove the blade. Afterward, bend the razor until it snaps in two. Take both pieces and stick them in the power outlet, then slip the razor blades alongside them in the outlet together, which heats them. Wrap the pieces of pencil lead in toilet paper, touch the two razor blades in the outlet together, and presto, an electric zap will ignite the toilet paper and make a fire. It was like total MacGyver shit that people had spent years in there perfecting. My own innovation was to make drumsticks out of pencils and razors, and drum heads out of food trays and plumbing. As I sat there, banging with pencils on my bowl, I realized that I had come full circle, and was sitting here at age 36, doing exactly what I had done at age 3 when I made my own drum set in my parents' kitchen. One day, I was sitting in my cell and I heard a commotion outside. I jumped up to my little square window and smashed my face against the glass, trying to figure out what was going on. Walking down the corridor with two guards carrying a guy who was dead as fuck. His whole body was stiff and his lips were a purplish blue. I banged on my cell door, asking everyone in sight what had happened, but no one said a word. Later, I asked a sheriff who passed my cell, and he just kept walking. A few days later, one of the orderlies gave me a newspaper, a rare gift. Inside, there was an article about the Los Angeles County Men's Central Jail I was in downtown. A black inmate had died because the white guards beating him didn't stop in time. The article said that advocacy groups were fighting for the county to install a surveillance system in the prison because conditions were so bad. As I read that stuff and thought of the dead guy and all the beatings I had heard in the last 2.5 months, I began to freak out. Where was I? I used to be a fucking rock star. In jail, I wasn't shit. I was just a maggot on lockdown. I couldn't fucking whine to my manager every time I didn't get my way. There was no audience to laugh at my goofing off, and no one wanted to hear my bullshit. I couldn't be a whiny little baby anymore. I had to be a man, or at least a big maggot, because I was being stepped on all the time, both in jail and in the real world. Pamela had started writing me some awesome letters and leaving me sweet voicemail messages. But just as my hopes began to lift, I found out from fucking Nikki and some other bros that she was dating her old boyfriend, Kelly Slater. I couldn't fucking believe it. I spent hours on the phone with my therapist crying. I couldn't understand how this shit could be happening to me. If I was home, at least I could be with friends or drive over to her place to talk about it. But here I was, completely fucking powerless. I just sat in my cell on fire. Then I learned my next important lesson: how to let go of things very quickly. I realized there wasn't shit I could do about it. Suck it up and leave it be. On Saturdays, I was allowed to have visitors. Nikki came down a bunch of times and Mick stopped by once, but said he was never coming back because the guards were mean to him and made him tuck in his shirt and remove his baseball cap. Vince never visited, and I wasn't surprised. The best visit of all, however, came from my lawyer, when he informed me that if nothing went wrong, he'd have me out in just under 4 months instead of 6, and that meant I only had a month left to go. I began to meditate on what it would take to make Tommy happy again. I'd been spending a lot of time thinking about being a good father, husband, and human being, but I hadn't really been taking care of my creative problems, and the musical part of me is like fucking 80 to 90%. I needed to do something new, and the way I saw it, That frustration had spilled over into my personal life. So I made a fucking decision. When Nicky visited the next Saturday, I looked at him through the bulletproof glass and squirmed in my seat. He was my best fucking bro, but I had to tell him, "Bro, I can't do it anymore." It was the hardest thing I ever had to say to anyone. His eyes widened, his mouth dropped open, and he just said, "Whoa." He looked like a guy who thought he was in the perfect marriage, suddenly discovering that his wife had been cheating on him. Of course, I had been cheating on him. Earlier in jail, I asked a friend to leave a message on my answering machine saying that it accepted all collect calls. That way, whenever I had an idea for a melody or lyrics, I could just record it on my machine to listen to when I got out. And these weren't melodies or lyrics for Motley Crue. I was ready to move on to some new shit. I continued to compile music from my cell on my answering machine until September 5, the day I was scheduled to leave. I lay in my bunk, waiting for the loudspeaker to crackle, "Lee, roll it up!" Which meant roll up your bed, blankets, and shit, because you're out of here. I was told I'd be out at noon, but noon rolled by and nothing happened. Slowly, the clock crept to 2 o'clock. Every minute was agony. Then it was 3, 4, 5 o'clock. Next thing I knew, it was dinner time. I kept telling everyone, "Dude, I'm supposed to be out." But no one would listen to me. Midnight struck, and they still hadn't called me. The old Tommy Lee would have bashed his head against the bars until someone paid attention to him. But the new Tommy Lee knew that there was nothing he could do but suck it up and accept it. I stretched out in my bunk, pulled the threadbare blanket up to my neck, and went to sleep. At 1:15 in the morning, I was woken up by a voice on the loudspeaker. "Lee, roll it up!"
Part 12. Hollywood Ending. Chapter 1. Sylvia Roan. In which the mighty potentate of the Elektra Disc Recording and Manufacturing Co. is interrogated on the subject of her latest favorite employees. "So, what do you want to respond to first? Their allegations that you are only interested in promoting R&B on the label and not rock and roll?" Sylvia Roan. "Elektra's track record speaks for itself when it comes to promoting and supporting rock artists on our roster. Metallica, AC/DC, Motley Crue. Motley Crue were the major priority for Elektra in 1997. We did a tremendous amount of promotion on the record's front end. But the market for rock music, especially with veteran bands, is in major transition right now. The album didn't perform to expectations, and their unhappiness is understandable, but it's not for lack of effort on the company's part." "What kind of efforts were made?" "In January, the label spent a substantial amount of money to have the band perform at the American Music Awards, after which we mounted a snipe campaign. We did a lot of promotion on the internet. We supported and underwrote the cost of a live performance at a rock station in Tampa in March. I could go on and on about the different promotional efforts that we've made." "What do you think about the incident with the security guard in South Carolina and the fact that they called you a cunt from stage?" "Those kind of remarks don't deserve any comment, but they are very ill-advised." "Will they affect how you deal with the band in the future?" "It doesn't affect my attitude toward the band. I'm a very professional person." "Their contract with Elektra expires in 2 albums. Will you renew it?" "At this point, that's very hard for me to say."
Chapter 2. Press clippings detail the resolution of our hero's latest adventure on a battlefield that has changed from the stage to the courts to, at present, the corporate boardroom. "I'm supposed to go into the studio in a couple of weeks, and I have a contract with Sylvia Roan, and she won't give me my money. I don't understand. She's fucking the fans, she's fucking herself, and she's fucking me. I have 4 kids, a wife, I have house payments, car payments, I have a life. I fucking earned the right to have one of the biggest contracts in rock and roll. I don't need to be fucked with by somebody who has her opinion and her priorities. Is she a racist? Is she anti-man? What's your problem? We can't figure it out because she's had a hard-on for us since day one. Well, you know what, motherfucker? You've got a contract, and if you want to go up against this band, we are a loose cannon. I will make your life miserable. Nikki Sixx, quoted in Spin, March 1998. Anyone who saw the less-than-flattering comments that Motley Crue bassist Nikki Sixx made about the Elektra Entertainment Group and its chairman, Sylvia Roan, in the March issue of Spin will not be surprised to hear that the band and the record label have parted company. Sources said that Motley Crue, which spent 15 years on Elektra and sold more than 35 million albums, is looking into alternative means of distributing its catalog material. The band, which gave birth to glam metal with its 1982 album Too Fast for Love, is heading into the studio next month to record new songs. The Music Daily, April 16, 1998. Motley Crue is set to raise its middle digit to the world once more. This time, the vehicle is called Greatest Hits, and the wheels have already begun to burn a bit of rubber across a very limp and lifeless music industry. Elektra Records has been cast aside in favor of the Motley's own label and distribution network. An international tour of theaters and arenas to support the release is currently being planned, and Tommy is finally out of jail. Things, as they say, are about to happen. Sound420.com, August 1998.
Chapter 3. Tommy. Freed from incarceration, our hero rediscovers the pleasures of warm water, tobacco, and other men's wives. My friend Bob Prokop, who owned a diamond store on Rodeo Drive, picked me up from jail in his big, crazy-ass Bentley. "What's the first thing you want to do?" he asked. "Dude, I want a cigarette so fucking bad. And then, would you be so kind as to take me to your beach house?" We cruised down the freeway. Traffic was zipping by on all sides. After almost 4 months in solitary, it was too much stimulation for me. I smoked an American Spirit and closed my eyes to keep from throwing up all over the car. Bob brought me to his house in Marina Del Rey, right on the water. He filled his jacuzzi with half a box of bubble bath and said, "It's all yours, bro." I ripped my fucking clothes off, jumped in, tilted my head back, and just sat there for 2 hours, gazing at the stars. I had forgotten what it felt like to be immersed in actual, as opposed to metaphorical, hot water. It was the greatest luxury in the world. At about 4 a.m., I asked him to take me home. I missed my house and my bed. Pamela and the kids had moved out, so it was quiet and empty, with the toys and furniture mostly gone. I stumbled through the darkness to the bed where Brandon was born and fell asleep for 2 days straight. It was always hard to sleep in jail because of all the walking and talking and crashing and banging and reverberating off the concrete walls. When I woke up, my house was full of people. All these dudes had come over to welcome me home. They were kissing me and hugging me and slapping me on the back. But I was so unused to being around people that I didn't know what to say. I smiled, but inside I wanted to crawl under a rock and hide. It had been so long since another person had treated me with anything other than hostility and suspicion. It was too soon for me to laugh and be happy and carefree. I was still in a lot of pain. I asked the court for permission to go to Hawaii and fucking marinate. I brought Scott Humphrey along and sat on the beach and did nothing until I slowly returned to planet Earth. I relearned how to interact with people, and eventually, the smile came back. I didn't have to fake it anymore. But the world wasn't the same as when I had left it. Everyone looked at me differently now. People would pass by and whisper, "There's that fucking wife beater." I was really ashamed of myself, and it took a while to realize that the whole world wasn't against me. The other thing that had changed was that Pamela had made sure she finalized the divorce before my release. My family life, which had given me my greatest happiness and misery, seemed completely over. I couldn't figure out why she would do that to me and the children, but it was clear that, despite all the letters and phone calls, she didn't want anything to do with me. There was no chance of reconciliation, especially with her dating Kelly fucking Slater. That little turn of events, combined with the fact that I heard that she had changed her wedding band tattoo from Tommy to Mommy, upset me so much that I later had my wedding tattoo removed. I just wanted to get that shit off my finger and change my life. I had to become a single dad, something I had never wanted to be. My parents had stayed together my whole life. My dad, who was 74, was now ill with myeloma and cancer in his bloodstream. My mom, who was much younger, spent every day and night taking care of him. I wanted somebody in my life to do that for me. And I wanted somebody I could do that for. What made being a single father the worst, though, was that I wasn't allowed to fucking see my children without a court-appointed monitor there to supervise me. I felt so bad for Dylan and Brandon because they had no idea who these people were and what was going on. When I returned home from Hawaii, I put my blinders on, locked the doors, and pulled out all the notes and answering machine tapes I had made in jail. I invited over this filthy little rapper street kid named Tylo, who I had met when his old band, Head P, was opening for Motley Crue on the Swine Tour. And we started working on our own project, Methods of Mayhem. I buried myself in work, going at it every minute until 4 or 5 in the morning, and reaching out to everyone I had always wanted to work with. On my birthday, some friends threw a party for me because I hadn't kicked back and relaxed in months. Someone invited Carmen Electra, and we met and started bullshitting. She had married Dennis Rodman 4 months ago, but they were already, for all practical purposes, separated. I talked to her on the phone a few times, and 2 weeks later, just as I was about to hit the road with Motley for our greatest hits tour, we started dating. She would tell Rodman, who she claimed she had caught cheating on her with 2 women simultaneously, that she was going to visit sick grandmothers and shit while she sneaked off on the road with us. We had to smuggle her in and out of shows and hotels so that the tabloids didn't get hold of the information and have a field day. We were both refugees from the 2 fucking craziest celebrity insta-marriages of the year. Plus, when Pamela left Baywatch for her own VIP series, Carmen was hired as her replacement. Dennis Rodman had filed for divorce, but that didn't mean he wanted someone else dating her. So he started stalking the band and showing up at shows. We had to order security guards to keep him out by any means necessary. And, funnily enough, though I had been trying ever since my release from prison to get Pamela to talk or meet with me, as soon as word leaked out that I was dating Carmen, she mysteriously started calling again. Except for the visits from Carmen Rodman, I kept to myself during the Motley tour. I took my whole studio on the road and, after every gig, holed up in my room and worked on Pro Tools. I figured if I wrote nonstop, I'd have the Methods of Mayhem record done by the time I came home. Besides, it kept me from getting into any more trouble. In every city, I'd have to find a lab and pee in a cup before each show. And all day, I'd be on the phone with probation officers and anger management counselors and therapists and gurus. With my strict probation, it was like I was still in handcuffs. I couldn't go to restaurants, grocery stores, gas stations, anywhere that sold alcohol except, of course, the venues we played in. With each show, it became harder for me to play our greatest hits on stage. While I was out there playing Girls, Girls, Girls for the 10,000th time, all I could think about was getting back to my room and finishing whatever song I was working on. I was much happier on the Karabi tour. Even though no one was at the damn shows, at least I was doing something that fulfilled me. I had always told myself that when my heart wasn't in it, it was time to quit. And my heart wasn't in it. Nicky, however, was just as enthusiastic about Motley Crue as he was on the day we started the band, in his old girlfriend's home in North Hollywood, with me jamming on the fucking table while he sold light bulbs on the phone. With the band back on its own independent label, he felt like he was in control of his own destiny, and Motley Crue could take over the world again. I think he fucking thought that I would come around and see things his way, and stay in Motley Crue while releasing Methods of Mayhem as a side project. But if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it 100%. And I couldn't give Methods of Mayhem and Motley Crue 100%, especially after Vince sucker-punched me. We were at the Las Vegas airport heading back to Los Angeles after another leg of the never-ending Greatest Hits tour. Vince was highly intoxicated and, as usual, no fun to be around. I was standing at the ticket counter talking with Ashley, who worked for our record company and was taking care of our seats, when Vince walked up all shitty drunk and slurred,
"Give me my fucking boarding pass, Ashley. You can kiss Tommy's ass later."
Dude, I had no idea where all that fucking hostility came from. I guess I hadn't been happy since he rejoined the band. And sure, he wasn't my favorite dude on the planet, but I never did anything fucking mean to that guy. He just has so much pain bottled up that he doesn't share with anyone, and dude, I feel that. But when he said that shit in the airport, it didn't put me in a very sympathetic mood. What did you just say?
You fucking heard me,
he swaggered drunkenly.
Dude, what the fuck is wrong with you? Fuck you!
Fuck me?
Fuck you, bro!
And we were off in one of those shitty little fights that weren't so rare with us.
No, fuck you, you fucking poser piece of shit,
Vince bullied as he pushed his puffy face against mine.
What are you gonna do? Hit me?
He knew damn well that I was on probation, and he tried everything he could to get me to violate it by kicking the shit out of him. I refused to take the bait, putting my anger management training to use.
Look, dude, I said, I'm not gonna fucking hit you. You need to calm down, big guy. Let's just forget about it and take it easy.
Then, out of nowhere, he fucking clocked me on the jaw. And when you get hit like that, suddenly anger management goes out the window and your animal defense system kicks in. My immediate reaction was to fucking kill. Even though I just had assault charges and prison and counselors up the ass, I couldn't help it. Here was this asshole coming out of nowhere and getting up in my shit. I fucking tackled him, knocked him to the ground, and cocked my arm to send this smug shithead to the hospital.
I did not give a fuck. Send me back to jail. Fine.
But my fist was going to have a band meeting with Vince's face first. Suddenly, Chris, our security guard, dove on me. He was under strict orders to make sure I didn't get in any trouble, and it was his ass if I was sent back to prison. He pulled me off Vince and said,
Tommy, get on the plane and get the fuck out of here. Now!
As I turned to walk to the gate, Vince stood up and screamed at the top of his lungs for airport security.
Police! Police! I've been assaulted!
The fucking guy had just sucker punched me. And now he was trying to get me arrested and put back in prison. It would have been 10 years on ice if I was arrested.
You just don't do that to another human being, especially your bandmate, no matter how pissed you are.
I ran onto the plane and said to Nikki, Bro, I am out of here. You will not see me tomorrow. You will not see me the next day. You guys had better find yourselves another drummer. This tour is over.
Chapter 4 Vince. A duel amongst gentlemen is seen from an alternate perspective, and the effects of breast enhancement on a party to the duel are considered. I was talking to Ashley Smith, the publicist at our record company, when Tommy, being who he is, jumped in the middle of the conversation. He had nothing to do with what we were talking about. When I told him to keep his mouth shut, he grabbed me by the neck. "Take your fucking hands off me right now," I ordered him. We were in the middle of a crowded airport, and there were thousands of witnesses. If he didn't watch himself, he was going to get thrown back in prison. So I warned him again, take your fucking hands off me. And when he didn't, I knocked him to the ground. So I wouldn't say that's a sucker punch. I'd say he's just a sucker who got punched. Tommy can be the most fun guy in the world to be around. His only problem is that he's so scared other people won't like him that he lies to make himself look better. That's the way he is, and that's the way he always will be. He's a chameleon. Whatever is in, he wants to do that. He never really stuck to what made him what he was, which was rock and roll. If hip-hop is in, he's a hip-hopper. If punk is in, he's a punk rocker. If Tommy had fucking tits, he'd be a Spice Girl.
Chapter 5 Nikki. In which reflections on 20 years of bonhomie and discontent are shared on the occasion of a tragic dissolution. When Tommy was released from prison, he didn't call anyone in the band. I didn't find out until 3 days later that he was even out of jail. And the way I found out was because someone had seen him in a mall. I was furious. I had visited him almost every week. I did everything I could to keep him sane in there, even starting a letter-writing campaign to get him an early release. So when he didn't even let me know he was out, it felt like a slap in the face. I called him and said, "What's going on? Why didn't you tell me you were out?" "What's the problem?" he bristled. "It's not my job to report to you." Throughout the Greatest Hits tour that followed, he was cold and aloof. He was a time bomb ticking with resentment. It was only a matter of time before he blew. So when everyone turned against Vince after the fight in the airport, I saw it for what it really was. Tommy throwing gasoline on a fire. Sure, Vince was being a jerk to our publicist, But at the same time, Tommy took a bad situation and made it worse by grabbing Vince by the neck. On the plane afterward, Tommy became very emotional and started crying while Vince sat as far away as he could, sulking and indignant. They were like two little kids. I'd seen this kind of thing happen between any two of us a million times. But when the dust settled, we were a band. Everyone made mistakes. Everyone was an asshole sometimes. On the plane, I told them the new game plan. Listen, we're right where we want to be. We have our own label now. So we can reissue our old albums with all the unreleased tracks the fans have been asking for, make a new album of pure kick-ass rock, and by September of 2001, take some time off and work on whatever solo project we want. But Tommy wasn't having any of it. Back in L.A., he refused to talk to Vince and make peace. And Vince refused to talk to Tommy. They were both wrong, but neither would admit it. And I knew that if they would just sit down like Vince and I had after our fight on the swine tour, they could settle their issues. But the best I could do was talk Tommy into finishing the tour. Fine, he told me. But I want my own tour bus, and I want my own dressing room, and don't even think about putting me on the same airplane as that dickhead. I don't want to see that asshole until the lights come on, and when we come off stage, you better fucking take him in one direction and me in the other. I don't want to fucking run into him, because, dude, I don't trust myself. When we came home from the tour, a friend called and told me to turn on K-Rock because Pamela Anderson was being interviewed. She said that she and Tommy were back together again, and that Tommy had decided to leave Motley Crue to record a solo album. That was how I found out Tommy had left the band, from Yoko Ono on K-Rock. I called Tommy, but he wouldn't return my calls. I stopped by his house, but he wouldn't answer the door. I wrote him letters and emails, but he never responded. He was just gone, as if the past 20 years of friendship and music didn't exist. It hurt immensely, but it doesn't anymore.
Chapter 6 Mick. Of a notable adventure concerning such fantastic creatures of the imagination as ghosts, aliens, and psychiatrists. I told my doc that I'd been having a hard time falling asleep and a hard time forcing myself out of bed in the morning. He said, "You are depressed." I could have told him that. I'd been depressed for years. I was in pain every day and worn out from years of driving 780 miles to each gig with a band that's still squabbling like titty babies. It was getting pretty hairball. My feeling when Tommy left the band was that if you're not into what you're doing, then you're not going to do your best. And then you're going to start resenting the people who you think are holding you back so that every petty little thing gets blown way over the top, like in the airport with Vince. So if Tommy wants to leave the band, let him get it out of his system and see for himself whether he was right or wrong. Like when I was in Whitehorse, they kept telling me I couldn't play as good as everyone else, so I followed my gut feeling and left to do what I really wanted. And in the end, it was me who had the last laugh. So who knows what will happen with Tommy? For my depression, the doctor prescribed Zoloft and Wellbutrin. I went home figuring I'd shake my lethargy, quit smoking, get some energy, and go out and do stuff. Nope. I took the pills and was instantly transported to another dimension. At night, I'd wake up in a panic, thinking that I was being abducted by aliens or observed by ghosts. But I'd look around and nothing would be there. Suddenly, weird shit would start dripping from the ceiling and rising out of the floor. I called the doctor and told him what was happening. And he said to stick with the medication because my system would soon adjust. For 3 straight weeks, I was on a non-stop acid trip. Each day, I journeyed further and further out of my mind. When I walked on my beige carpet, I'd see the prints of my boots glowing phosphorescent orange. I was sure something was about to snap, and I was either going to kill myself or take out one of my guns and spray the whole neighborhood. I knew my brain was thinking wrong, but there was nothing I could do to stop it. Finally, I went to see a psychiatrist, and he diagnosed me as a schizophrenic. Being depressed seemed like nothing in comparison with being a schizophrenic. The psychiatrist gave me another pill to keep the other drugs in check, and then he called my orthopedic specialist and told him to cut off the pain medication, I took for my back because he was worried I was becoming an addict. I was never an addict. I'd make a 10-day supply of pills last a month. But now, thanks to all these doctors, I was schizophrenic and in constant pain from 30 years of cumulative bone disease. Plus, as a side effect from one of their pills, my hands started swelling and I couldn't play the guitar. My brother moved into my house to take care of me. And that night, my mattress started undulating under me and making serpentine movements. I thought it was my imagination again, but in the morning my brother asked what I had put in the bed to make it shake like it did. Now I had no idea what was real and what was illusion. I've always known that the things scientists and governments tell us are wrong, but now I was seeing proof for the first time. The drugs had opened up a window into the spirit world, and there was no doubt that some of the things I was seeing really existed. But in order to function in the everyday world, our minds have to narrow the field of perception to a small sliver of reality and exclude the rest. Unfortunately, as an inhabitant of planet Earth, I had to go back to living in it. So I called the doc again and begged him to take me off the pills. He told me to be patient and wait to adjust. That day I started hearing a radio very faintly in another room, but when I plugged my ears, the music and voices grew louder. They were in my head. The final straw came when I was in bed and a marshy gray ghost pinned me to the mattress. I started yelling at him, "Let me up or I will break your fucking neck," but he pinned me there for an hour. The next night the gray ghost returned, but this time I grabbed him and he disappeared. When I woke up in the morning with the usual aches in all my joints that made it so hard to even stand up, I realized that the gray ghost was my ankylosing spondylitis made flesh. That's what had been holding me back my whole life. That day, I called my doctor again, and he assured me that these were normal side effects. "I don't think they are," I said. "They feel like acid flashbacks." "Okay," he sighed. "Then come in." As soon as I walked in the office, I could see in his eyes that he was afraid. I looked like death in boots.
Chapter 7. Tommy. In which our hero, having journeyed from boy to man, arrives at his final discovery: to stay away from that which hurts him. I think the band always blamed Pamela for influencing me to leave. They called her motherfucking Yoko and set up a dartboard with her face on it in their dressing room. But she never told me to leave. Yeah, she could see the dysfunction in the band, but every decision I ever made musically, I always made on my own. The fact that I left the band never should have been a surprise to Nicky. I had told him reams of times, but I guess he just didn't want to really believe it after all we'd been through. For some reason, Nicky and Pamela never clicked, which was always fucked up to me because she introduced Nicky to Donna. She whipped out her Cupid's arrow, shot them both, and it's been puppy love ever since. I think Vince had issues with Pamela too because he claimed they had fucked, though she says they never did. But he was never as angry as Nicky, who to this day hates Pamela's guts. I used to feel that way myself. After the divorce and sitting around helpless while she hooked up with her ex, I told myself that there was no fucking way. I accepted as gracefully as I could the fact that I had been fired. Whenever I came by for the boys, she'd have the nanny of the week bring the kids out and pretend like she wasn't home. Just like with Bobby Brown, Pamela and I couldn't stay away from each other. First, she suddenly started calling me again when I was dating Carmen. Then, one afternoon when I went to pick up the boys, the nanny wasn't there, and Pamela came out instead. Instantly, we both felt, despite everything we'd been through, the magic, the initial attraction that had brought us together that New Year's Eve 5 years before. After that, each time I went over for the kids, we'd kick it a little bit, until one day we found ourselves kicking it in her bed. Then I started staying the night and spending more and more time with her until we were practically married again. I asked her to move back to my place, and that day she went to the court, bro, and finally withdrew my restraining order. We even planned to remarry on Valentine's Day. But we quickly fell into the old patterns because we'd never really dealt with our issues. It was hard to get her to talk about them, which made our attempts at therapy a complete waste. Instead of working on things, she liked to give ultimatums like, If you drink, I can't be with you. The little boy that was me before jail hated ultimatums, but now I tried to accept them as part of her personality. At the same time, however, there were so many minds in our relationship we hadn't diffused that we both ended up tiptoeing around each other so as not to fucking explode any. It all fell apart for us again on New Year's Eve. We were sitting on our asses watching TV, and I said, "You know what? It's New Year's Eve. It's the 5th anniversary of when we met, and tomorrow is going to be another fucking millennium. Let's have a shot of Goldschlager for old time's sake, chill in the jacuzzi, and have a good time." She agreed. For a few days afterward, when we had some time alone, we'd sneak a drink together and veg out. But afterward, she freaked, because by drinking we had stepped on one of those minds.
"Oh my God," she kept saying. "I can't believe I drank with you. I'm not supposed to be doing this."
And so when the guilt came back, the drama of the past followed. Just as all this was going down, I had to split for a tour with Methods of Mayhem. When I returned home, she was out of town on a television shoot. We kept missing each other, and the distance and lack of communication were destroying us. And then, on Valentine's Day, I was fired again. Out of the blue, she said,
"I just can't do this anymore."
And she took the kids and bolted. She completely disappeared. I called her family and friends, but no one would tell me where she was. When she finally called a week later, it was to talk about custody of Dylan and Brandon. She wanted me to sign a one-sided agreement that basically gave her complete control of the kids. I told her no way, and as soon as I did, the district attorney was calling my lawyer, saying that she had a witness willing to testify that I had been drinking in violation of probation, and we both knew who that witness was. I spent 5 more days in jail, but I got to keep my boys. Last time in solitary, I had looked inward and resolve the problems in my fucking stunted mental development. Then, I looked outward and resolve the problems in my stunted musical development, because prison was the one place no one could get into my head and manipulate me. This time, I used the time in solitary to solve the last missing piece of the puzzle: my fucked up love life. I made 3 promises to myself. The first was never to get married again after knowing someone for only 4 days. The second was to make sure I met someone's mother before I married them, which would have saved me a lot of grief with Pamela and Heather because they were both pretty much younger versions of their mothers. And the third was that my next girlfriend was not going to be anyone who has ever been in a movie, magazine, or even for that matter, Hollywood. She was going to work at a cosmetics counter at a mall in Northbrook, Illinois, or at a law office in Raleigh, North Carolina. When I left prison, I knew there would be no third time with Pamela. I wasn't going to be angry or vindictive. In fact, I still loved her and always will. We share 2 children and are both going to be in each other's lives forever, so we might as well try to be friends. I also promised myself that I wouldn't sell my pad because I wanted our kids to always be able to come back to the house they were born and raised in. I set up a new studio in the house the day I returned and went to work on another Methods of Mayhem album. The other day, I took a break to get some food from the market near my house, and while I was shopping, I happened to run into Nikki's ex-wife, Brandy. We talked for a while, and afterwards she called a mutual friend to get my phone number. She called yesterday and said she lived right around the corner, so I might have to fucking get in on that. After all, I'm Mr. Single right now. And besides, I just looked through Nikki's chapters in this book and read all about him and Honey.
Chapter 8. Nikki. Of a final adventure which befalls our hapless hero, and other weighty matters indispensable for the clear understanding of this history. Strangely, with Tommy gone, the band entered for the first time in my memory a period of stability, and we recorded the album that should have been the successor to Dr. Feelgood, New Tattoo. The high and dark emotions of the Generation Swine era were starting to resolve themselves. I had dealt with my father in my own way, won joint custody of my children from Brandy, put the band back on track, and reissued our old albums on Motley Records, where they sold more than 5 times as many copies as Elektra had been selling. But then I received a phone call from my brother Randy. He had found out where our sister Lisa was living, in a sanitarium in Santa Cruz. I was determined to see her. After all the heroin, cocaine, and alcohol, I was finally waking up to who I really was. I called my mom and asked her why she had always kept me away from Lisa, but all she could do was repeat over and over, "It was different back then." I hung up on her and called the clinic. "I don't care what anyone says," I threatened. "I'm going to come down there and see my sister." "What do you mean?" a friendly nurse asked. "Who told you that you couldn't see Lisa? You can come see her whenever you wish." "But my mother told me Lisa didn't want to see family." "You could have seen her any time you wanted. You were always welcome. We were wondering why you never called. Can you do me a favor? I want to know more about her." They told me that her birthday was November 12th, that she had Down syndrome, was blind and mute, and was confined to a wheelchair. She had an extremely weak heart and weighed less than 60 pounds. "However, she has her full hearing," they said. "And it's strange what you chose to do with your life, because she loves music. All she does every day is sit by the radio." I felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown. I couldn't believe that I had such an amazing sister who I could have seen any time in the past 40 years. I was leaving for the next leg of the new tattoo tour in a few days, so I told the nurse I'd visit Lisa when I returned. 3 days after I came home from the tour, Jeff Varner from my management office called and said, "The police are here. They want your address." "Well, give them a message from me," I began the usual reply. "Tell them to fuck off. If they come to my house, they're wasting their time. I won't be there." "Look, they really need to see you," Varner said. "Well, I don't give a fuck. I'm sick of getting arrested and going to jail. Besides, I haven't done anything." Actually, there were a lot of things I had done. 2 days before, my car had been confiscated, and I was thrown in jail for driving without a license. And before that, a security guard I had brawled with in Greensboro on the swine tour had pressed charges. So maybe the cops were trying to extradite me to South Carolina. "Nikki," Varner pleaded, "trust me, you have to tell them where you live and let them come over." "No, I'm not going back to jail. You know what? Get rid of them and book me a flight to somewhere nice in South America. I need a vacation anyway." "Okay, Nikki," he sighed. "Let me call you right back." My phone didn't ring again for an hour. When it did, Vince was on the other line. He sounded fucked up, but not drunk. He was crying. "Nikki, man, I don't know how to tell you this," he began. "What? What?" "They just found your sister dead." "Who? Which sister?" I wasn't sure if it was Lisa or my half-sister, Cece. "I don't know, but that's why the police are at the office. They're trying to tell you." I called the office and found out that Lisa had died of a heart attack that morning. I fell into an instant depression. I was angry at myself for postponing my visit, and I was pissed at my relatives for keeping her a secret all my life. I thought about how we had flown to San Jose on our private plane during the girls' tour for 4 sold-out nights at the local arena, shooting up coke before going on stage, then performing in front of tens of thousands of screaming fans and popping flashbulbs and horny girls and admiring guys. And the whole time my sister with Down syndrome was a mile away in diapers, lying on her back and listening to the radio alone. I could have tried to find her back then. I could have sent her birthday cards. I could have given her money and better care so that maybe she'd still be alive. I could have easily used the $500,000 we made at those shows to start a Down syndrome fund in her name. Always ready to do too little too late, I went to Santa Cruz, bought the most beautiful little casket I could find, and arranged her funeral. It was there that I saw my sister for the first and last time. Though her hands and spine were deformed, her eyes looked exactly like mine. I was with my mother, Cece, and Donna, and I sat with them and cried the whole time. "I'm sorry," I must have told Lisa 100 times that night. "I will see you in heaven." Afterward, she was cremated. For Lisa's sake, I forgave my mother, took the urn back to Los Angeles, and built an angel statue with wings. I wanted to give Lisa the present of freedom and mobility, because she had never been able to walk. I bought a small plot of land at the top of a mountain and buried the urn underneath the statue there, so that wherever I am in Los Angeles, I can see her and be near her and be reminded that I'm not alone in this world and that any day I may leave it to join her. It was my first step toward straightening out all the crooked roads of my past. I never realized before that I had the power to break the chain of secrecy and dishonesty and irresponsibility that I had inherited. And I could do that simply by having a solid relationship with my wife and family, so that my children wouldn't spend their lives lost and hiding from everything like I had. Of course, those resolutions are easier spoken than applied. Thanks in part to our fucked up backgrounds, Donna and I haven't had the most easy marriage. But I've learned that human relationships, like band relationships, take work and compromise. And I'm putting everything I have into this one. We even started seeing a family counselor, which is great, because for the first time there was someone in my life who sits there, listens to me, and isn't afraid to call me out when I'm full of shit or lying to myself, which I've always been very good at. I've spent so long being a rock and roll cliche that I don't want to be a father cliche as well. Recently, Donna found out that she was pregnant with a girl, our first child together. My father's name was Frank, and Frank was the name that was forced upon me when I was born. But in refusing to keep that name as a teenager, I overthrew my family and my past. Now that I'm 41, I want it back again. So Donna and I have chosen a name for the girl, Frankie Jean. The Jean comes from Donna's mother's name, Jeanette. The way I look at it, we've taken our families, glued them together, and finally closed the circle on my father. As I write this, my knees are on the floor, and I'm praying that I can keep the circle together, unbroken, forever.
Chapter 9. Mick. Of the omens Mick Mars sensed on entering his physician's office and other matters which adorn and confirm this great history. The moment the doctor saw me, he took me off the Zoloft and Wellbutrin. But I continued to hallucinate from the aches and pressures in my bones. I still heard the radio voices and the bed undulated every night. I went to my orthopedic specialist to beg him to put me back on pain medication. I told him that my shoulders and neck had frozen, that I had to crank my guitar up a notch whenever I played, and that I had to move my whole body in order to tilt my head back. He didn't need to hear all that. He just looked at me, more scrunched up than ever, and said, "You're losing the battle." And he was right. The ankylosing spondylitis was taking over. The gray ghost was winning. The doctor put me back on pain pills and gave me a drug that was basically lightweight psychological Valium. The gray ghost could have my body, but I was going to keep my mind, thank you very much. Slowly, the voices in my head died down and my bed stopped rocking at night. Now, I only feel insane half the time. The other half, I am insane. A few years back, I had met a thin, mysterious girl named Robbie, an underwater photographer who had blown her ear out during a 200-foot dive and was now working in the production office on tour to see how creatures above sea level behaved. She talked with the intelligence and wit of a 40-year-old, though she was only in her 20s. The way she carried on a conversation was something I could never do. Everything she said sounded composed and thought out. I was so captivated by her that after the tour, I wrote down her phone number, left her a message, and eventually flew to Tennessee to visit her. I did not return alone. As Robbie and I spent more time together, and she became my only friend, I realized that she was the woman I had been trying to find all my life, but had failed to, miserably. She wasn't into drinking or drugging or nasty stuff, and consequently, she has helped me stay on the straight and narrow. Plus, she wasn't after my money because she had her own company, Nature Films, which supplies photos and footage for my second favorite things next to the guitar, the Discovery Channel, the Learning Channel, and the National Geographic Channel. Vince has Heidi, Nikki has Donna, and now I have Robbie. Whenever I see her shots on TV, I smile and say, "That's my old lady." I'm an old fart now, so it's hard for me to tour with the band. but I'm not as burnt out as I was during Generation Swine, because I realized that what makes me happy is playing what I wrote in the original ad in The Recycler that first led me to Motley. Loud, rude, and aggressive. Nicky's an old fuck, too, but he still wants Motley Crue to take over the world. That will never change about him. He always says, I want to win. And I know he still can. If I didn't believe that, I'd be with Tommy. When I returned home from the new tattoo tour, Robbie looked at me and smiled. What? I asked her. It's coming back, she said. What's coming back? The Purple People Eater. The wild magenta aura that Tom Zutop first saw, that I lost during the girls' tour. It had returned, but it's in the black stages now, sort of a waning purple.
Chapter 10. Vince. In which our hero learns the lesson that there is no lesson at all, there's only life. While we were touring in Japan, Heidi called. It was 5 a.m., so I knew that something had to be wrong. She said that my manager, Bert, was at his home in Nashville and trying desperately to reach me. I called him, and he could hardly force the words out. You're the only one I can talk to, he said. When I saw you go through this, I never thought that it would happen to me. Bert's son had been playing basketball the previous afternoon with some friends when he suddenly collapsed. A brain aneurysm had killed him on the spot, with no previous symptoms or warnings. After Japan, I flew directly to Nashville to stay with Bert. When Skyler died, he had been right there with me. Now it was my turn, because I knew exactly what he was going through. Tommy, Nicky, and Mick can rag on me about whatever they want, but they don't know. They wouldn't even be able to fathom what it's like to watch as your child dies. If they just put themselves in my shoes for a second, they would hate it. They can never go through that pain. Maybe then they'd understand why I fucking drink so much. My time with Bert was another reminder that life was short and love was rare. When I returned to L.A., I pledged to tie the knot with Heidi. After going out for 7 years, which was longer than I had ever been married, I realized that she was my soulmate. Other women had dated me for the good times, the Ferraris, the Porsches, the mansions, not to mention the incredible sex. But only Heidi had ever stuck around for the bad, through death, depression, and money problems. Heidi knew not to expect a rock and roll fairy tale, an expense account of $20,000 a month for purses, or a husband who had made it through life without the deep scars, guilt, and anger that come with having killed a good friend in a car crash and lost a 4-year-old daughter to cancer. Supposedly 85% of couples don't even make it through the death of a child, whether they are the natural parents or not. But somehow Heidi and I made it out the other end, not just as lovers, but also as best friends. We set a wedding date, and then celebrated the decision by going to watch the Kings play hockey. After the game, we ran into Tom Arnold, who introduced us to some of the players. They all wanted to party somewhere, so I suggested the Havana Room, a private cigar club in Beverly Hills, mostly for producers, actors, lawyers, and a plastic surgeon or two. I think I'm the only rocker who's a member. We were all getting sloshed there, except for Tom Arnold, who doesn't drink, when Mel Gibson, who was sitting alone at the bar, asked if he could join us. Eventually, the party wound down to just me, Mel, and Heidi at 3 a.m. The staff wanted to close, but they didn't want to kick us out, so they let us stay there by ourselves and smoke cigars. We left the club an hour later and drove to my house, shot pool, and took goofy Polaroids of each other until 6 in the morning. I passed out, but Mel still wanted a rock. Heidi shook me back to life in the afternoon, laughing. I can't believe I had to kick Mel Gibson out of the house. Sometime after sunrise, she had called him a taxi to take him back to the Four Seasons. That evening, Heidi and I turned on the news, which was broadcasting a story about how the Havana Room had burned down. They said that two gentlemen had stayed at the club late and thrown their lit butts in a trash can, which caught fire and set the place ablaze. Now, on top of everything else, I was an arsonist. Not long afterward, Heidi and I had a small but beautiful Beverly Hills wedding to the tune of Van Morrison's Crazy Love and a coterie of bridesmaids consisting almost entirely of playmates. After everything I had lost, I had a woman who was the most beautiful bride, the most amazing person inside and out that I had ever met. She was the only woman I've dated who could just be one of the guys, from putting money in strippers' G-strings on our first date to smoking stogies with Mel Gibson on our last date as an unmarried couple. I asked one of my closest friends in the whole world to be the best man at the wedding, Nikki Six. Afterward, Heidi and I returned to our house in Beverly Hills and adopted two German shepherds that liked to bite Nikki. I suppose the rest of the band would make fun of me for belonging to a cigar club, living in Beverly Hills, racing cars and trying to be some sort of entertainment mogul. I recently started a production company with Marco Garibaldi, his wife Priscilla Presley, and some stockbrokers from Chicago. We might even hire Doug Thaler to work in the mailroom. But what they don't understand is that I'm doing the same thing I always have. Instead of getting drunk with Tommy and Nikki and their drug dealers, I'm doing the same thing with Mel Gibson. Instead of kicking back and living the good life at the beach, I'm living the good life at the Havana Room. It's important to be true to yourself and not lose your identity by trying too hard to conform to everyone else's expectations and rules. After the insanity of the girls' tour, I think we lost sight of ourselves. Motley Crue became a sober band, then we became a band without a lead singer, then we became an alternative band. But what everybody always loved Motley Crue for was being a fucking decadent band, for being able to walk in a room and inhale all the alcohol, girls, pills, and trouble in sight. I suppose a happy ending would be to say that we learned our lesson and that it's wrong. But fuck that. I like to drink every now and then, and I like to get in trouble. I couldn't be the lead singer of Motley Crue if I didn't. I've been through lawsuits, divorce, addiction, suicide attempts, and more death than I even want to think about. It is time to have fun again. That's why when we hired my old buddy Randy Castillo to take Tommy's place on drums and locked ourselves in the studio to record New Tattoo, it was so easy. There was no brain damage, no waiting 2 weeks to get a guitar tone or snare to sound just right. We went back to basics and finally accepted the fact that we are Motley Crue. We're not a rap band, we're not a pop band. We are nothing but a band that sings about the joys of booze and sex and cars. We are a band that thrives on being unsettled. We thrive on fighting and teaming up three against one. We thrive on me getting fired, Tommy quitting, Nikki overdosing, and Mick being a nutty old man. Everything that should have killed us has only made us more dangerous, powerful, and determined. If I had been on MTV when they asked the band about chicks, fire, and hairspray, I wouldn't have gotten defensive like Nikki. I would have said, you know what? We are about fucking fire, we are about chicks, and we are about hairspray. And that's a whole lot better than being about boredom.
Chapter 11. Tommy. Of an ending, a new beginning, and a buried hatchet. I was walking up the steps to drop my kids off for their first day of school. I looked up and saw Nikki standing in silhouette at the top of the stairwell. It looked like a dream that I often had about him. It had been a year since I last saw or talked to Nikki. I met him at the top of the stairs and said hi. He nodded back at me. "Do your kids go here too?" I asked. "Yeah," he answered. "They're right there, in that classroom." "What a trip. Our kids are in the same class, bro." We were both dressed in slacks and button-down shirts. It was unnatural for us, but we didn't want our kids to be embarrassed by their dirty rock and roll dads. Nikki smiled at me, and we hugged. It was tripped out. Here were two guys who fucking killed the planet together, meeting again on the steps of a fucking elementary school. "I've never been here before," I told Nikki. "Which way do I go to get to the classroom?" He led me into the building and pointed down the hallway. I told him I'd be back in a minute. I wanted to make sure my son was settled and happy. Nikki said he'd wait, and when I was finished, maybe we'd grab breakfast together and talk about old times. But I ended up staying with Brandon for half an hour because he was nervous and frightened. When I returned to the lobby, no one was there. I ran out of the building to the top of the steps and looked around. Nikki had disappeared. I walked down the steps and peered into the window of the classroom to make sure Brandon was making friends. And he was. He was sitting there laughing at something. I took another step forward to see what he was laughing at and saw Nikki's son, Decker, taking off his shirt. A whole new generation of Sixes and Lees, and Neils and Marses, was about to be let loose on the world.
And so our heroes ended their two-decade odyssey of unison and animalistic adventuring, having learned lessons great, small, and none at all. We shall leave them now, to carry on their motley ways, to grow more wise, to love their wives, and to pay alimony all their lives, to read their children this story, to play for crowds in glory, and to return time and time again to the federal reformatory. Dear reader, turn around to gaze on their backs once more, and you shall see them fade from view, galloping into the waning sun to conquer new lands, singing a new tune that shall always be the same tune, and it goes something like this. Spent $1 million on amphetamines, crashed a lot of cars, fucked all the stupid stars in Hollywood, because I could, because we could. So you loved to hate us in your private jets. Funny how you bitched and moaned, 'cause you got fat and rich. And when I'm dead, all you'll put on my headstone is that. I'm so fake, I'm a dirty little bastard. Fake, I was always so plastered. Fake, so you say it's true. Fake, I'm a dirty little whore. Fake, I'm everything and more. Looks like I'm fake. Just like you. 40 billion records and going strong. Never got a Grammy. Still won't play along in Hollywood like we should. My diamond ring and cocaine binges, all strung out on your syringes. Sold my soul while you sold records. I've been your slave forever. You're so fake. You're a dirty little bastard. Fake. You're always so plastered. Fake, so you say it's true. Looks like I'm a fake, just like you. I'm not bitter. I'm just better.
This is Roger Wayne. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Dirt, Confessions of the World's Most Notorious Rock Band, by Tommy Lee, Vince Neil, Nikki Six, and Mick Mars. Presented by Day Street Books and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2001 by Motley Crue. Production copyright 2019 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.